Hello everyone, I think we might make a start, being 10:30. So welcome to you all here today and welcome to the people that are on webinar. So my name is Catherine Nance, I'm partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers and I look after a team that works in retirement incomes and investments, and also I've been involved I think in every review going right back to the Henry and Harmer reviews, so IGR, FS Inquiry, you name it, basically I've been involved with it. Alan Stevens is one of the other members of the working group, and I'll let Alan introduce himself.
All right, I'm Alan Stevens. I work for RAS One. I'm a senior consultant there. Reason for this, I'm doing quite a lot of work in policy, public policy areas. So the previous paper that the Institute put out on For Richer For Poorer, that was a fair chunk of it was written by me. But and then moved on to housing. Yeah.
So the format today is I'm going to run through a presentation about where we're at in terms of the working group on this subject, which is looking at the role that housing will play and the policy. The aim is that we're developing a policy paper for the Actuaries Institute on this subject. I think it'll be easier if questions are basically left to the end. We've got a lot of time for questions at the end. And not just questions, but we just want to hear your views as well. So the people on webinar will be able to send them through as we go, and they'll get presented to us at the end. And can I just encourage anyone who is speaking, you'll have to use a microphone so that people on webinar can hear. But if you can also go through and state your name and your company, that would be very helpful for us. So if we get started, so as I said, I'm going to run through a brief presentation looking at housing wealth, needs in retirement, the role that housing plays both now and possibly into the future, the objectives that we set for doing this work, and also the principles that we set for any reform options. And I'm going to be presenting our draft reform options to you for your comments. So they're our views at the moment, but this is a very important session to actually gain input back from the Institute members on those possible options. We are expecting to get a lot of input. We are expecting for people to disagree with where we've come up to things and to debate things, and that will be really helpful for us to help formulate our views. So there will be an open panel discussion. Alan and I will be basically that panel. And particularly we want your feedback on the options. We want any other options that we've not addressed. In some ways, we have specifically excluded some things from consideration, and I'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to the subject. We're also very careful about where we're drawing the line between our reform options. We don't want to derail a debate that may be difficult anyway. But also we'd like your views on what is the best way in which we can encourage informed debate, because it's easy for debates around these subjects. It's a bit like tax reform or age pension changes. It's very easy for debates to get derailed, you know, by media picking up, oh, you want to punish, you know, a sort of poor old lady with a house in Sydney or something like that, or you want to punish someone else, or you want to pay, you know, a universal pension to someone. That's not in scope here. But it's very easy for debates to get derailed. So we're trying to position this in a way in which we can really encourage informed debate on the principles, and not so much line up every detail at this point in time. So it's a conscious decision that we're making in that regard. The Productivity Commission is doing a report on this subject, and it is due later this year, probably December, and Ken Baxter is here from the Productivity Commission, so we'd welcome any comments, Ken, that you have. And our policy is due to be finalised also later this year. We see this policy as being an extension of the retirement incomes policy, which came out in November 2014. We're following the same principles. We've just slightly tailored them a little bit to pick up the greater role that housing plays. The retirement incomes policy, just to remind you, addressed a number of area policy reforms, such as looking at encouraging people to take income streams through measures such as intelligent defaults in retirement, removing impediments to ongoing work, removing the legislative barriers to annuities. We weren't saying in that retirement incomes policy that annuities were the answer for everyone, but really just making sure that there is a market there of options for people to utilise. Linking the pension age to improvements in longevity. And basically looking at an efficiency review of the whole system, how the age pension and the tax costs relate to aged care and health costs. Because a lot of the debate, as you know at the moment, is on tax reform. And there's a very important point of tax reform that often gets missed, is that if you take more tax from super, you will actually largely, you will get that revenue in the shorter term, but you will largely pay it back in the longer term through increased age pension outlays. So everything's connected. And so it's really important that we keep that in mind. So to start off with the background. So the background is our retirement income system is based on three pillars. We have a publicly funded age pension, which currently is paid to around 70% of people of pension age. And that percentage is not due to basically materially reduce over the next sort of 30, 40 years. It marginally comes down to about 67%. The number of people on a full age pension is expected to reduce. More people will receive a part age pension as the superannuation balances grow. But basically the bulk of our population will receive an age pension, and that's how the SG system was designed. It wasn't designed to replace the age pension. It was designed to work in conjunction with the age pension. The age pension is $22,000 for a single, $33,000 for a couple homeowners, and there's some rent assistance provided to renters, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. The other pillar is superannuation compulsory and voluntary. Currently, people retire with superannuation balances on average of $200,000 for a male, $100,000 for a female. Those averages are probably quite distorted by the public sector pension schemes. If you talk to the industry funds, people are retiring on a lot less than that. The average balances at the moment are $83,000 for men, $45,000 for females, and that includes people with nil balances, or $100,000 and $70,000 for men and women, if you exclude the roughly a bit under 20% of people that have no super. So super is a very important part of the retirement income system, but it's still quite embryonic and it will grow over time. And then there's other savings. And then there's housing wealth. Housing wealth is a considerable store of wealth. It's not often considered when we talk about our retirement income system. It's relatively untapped, but there's no doubt it's a fourth pillar. How significant is it? 85% of over 65s own their own home. The value of housing wealth for the over 65s is $1 trillion compared to $300 billion in super. So it's roughly three times the value of what people have in super. The majority, vast majority of wealth for over 75s is in their own home. That value has doubled over the past 20 years. If we look at one of these graphs, which comes from the For Richer For Poorer report that the Actuaries Institute put out this year, you can see that for an age 60, you may not be able to see it very clearly, but for a 60-year-old couple who are in the median wealth distribution, just under 50% of their wealth is in housing and most of the rest is in super. If you look at the 25th percentile, you get a high percentage of wealth is in housing, 66%. And if you, it's probably not really worthwhile going down to the 5th percentile. So it's a significant share of the wealth. Housing, like super, benefits from considerable tax concessions, such as capital gains tax-free and being excluded, the only exempt asset under the age pension. Now that's an important point, because when we're looking about how we should be funding the costs that come in later age, we need to remember that housing like super has had considerable tax concessions along the way. There's no doubt in our view that the increase in the value of that asset, the quantum of that asset, along with the increase in age expenditures, which picks up expenditures and aged care costs and health costs, means that housing will play an increased role in financing the future for older Australians. The Living Longer, Living Better aged care reforms in 2014, which reformed the aged care system, made it quite clear that accommodation costs, whether in-home or in-care, were the responsibility of the individual, with government only picking up a safety net role. Same for personal expenditure. And the only role where the government takes a major role, other than a safety net or a catastrophic protection net role, was in health costs through Medicare. So accommodation, personal expenditure, no matter whether you're at home or in a nursing care facility or an aged care facility, is basically our responsibility, subject to certain safety nets. So the role of housing now. What is the role now? So the role now is that people definitely consider it their home, and it provides security of tenure, which is very important. It is an important store of wealth. It's illiquid, but it's important. But the ways in which people are thinking about that wealth at the moment is that they're thinking about it as self-insurance against longevity and also against aged care costs, which is quite a rational assumption for people to make, to say, look, if I need to go into aged care and that's a considerable cost, then ultimately at the end of the day, I've got my house and I can use that to get me in there. In doing that, it can result in a lower standard of living during retirement, and it can also result in unintended bequests for adult children if they actually don't end up needing that housing wealth to pay for those things. There's also an important and often unstated but implied cross-generational contracts that are occurring for informal care. And personally, I know a couple of friends in this position where they do support quite actively an elderly relative. It may not be a parent, it may be an aunt that has no other family. And in return for that support, the implied contract is they will inherit the house. Now, that's quite an important cross-generational contract that we have to bear in mind, because the value of informal care is important and it is very valuable, and we do have to make sure that we don't upset some mechanisms that actually would be replaced by quite costly formal care. The other role of housing now is definitely bequests. There is still a view by many that they wish to leave a request. It's possible that that might change over time. The boomers may not be so nice to their kids. And equity relief schemes are currently very limited, less than 1% of the potential home equity market, and there's supply and demand constraints in that basis. So in terms of the demand constraints, from what the research we've done, is that the main constraints are there's an aversion to debt, it does affect their age pension entitlements, and if 70% of people are on the age pension, and possibly higher when you're getting into the ages like 80-year-olds that might be looking at these things. There's complexity associated with those contracts that elderly people often veer away from. There's a limited market in the providers. The known brands, like the big banks, don't, if they have the product, they definitely don't actively market it or actively encourage it. And there could be a view that they're expensive because the interest rate margin can be 1% to 2%, probably closer to 2% higher than other interest rates. So that's on the demand side. On the supply side, for a bank, for a major bank, it would represent a very small portion of their book, but with a very high possibility of risk. Things like elderly people ending up with no equity, families ending up with no bequests. There's big potential reputational risks involved for what is a very, very small portion of their book. And there's also lack of clarity in terms of the current regulation in ensuring that they meet some of the requirements, and I'll talk about that a little bit more now. So there's supply and demand constraints currently around equity release schemes. So the role of housing now, and I'm picking up the Productivity Commission survey that was done just recently as part of their work here, and it was publicised just recently, is that this was a survey done by the Productivity Commission. 75% of over 60s wanted to remain in home. 70% see the home as a financial safety net, which goes to those self-insurance type beliefs. Half had a bequest motive, which is quite high. Only 40% saw the home as a potential retirement asset, and 40% were uncomfortable with debt and retirement. So it's basically a snapshot of the views now. So I'm going to move on to needs in retirement. So there's two basic needs in retirement which I referred to before. There's personal expenditure, which is your day-to-day living costs, and there's your accommodation costs. There's also potentially health costs. So in terms of personal expenditure, the ASRA retirement standard is a good source of an indicator here. There's others. And it classifies a comfortable standard of living for homeowners aged 65 to 85 as being $58,000 for a couple and $42,000 for a single. And comfortable, for those that haven't sort of looked into this standard, represents a reasonably new car. It represents, you know, they've also got a modest standard, which is $34,000 for a couple and $23,000 for a single, which is not that dissimilar from the age pension rates. And how you basically describe comfortable to modest to age pension is that comfortable would be a fairly reasonable car. modest would be an old, less reliable car, and the age pension would be no car. That's sort of like trying to impart it. In terms of drinking, comfortable is a bottle of wine, cask wine, homebrew. So that's the sort of, like, just to give you a feel about the sort of quality of life on those measures. If you're a non-homeowner, the For Richer, For Poorer paper quoted that the cost of personal expenditure are possibly 30% higher for lower income people, which is pretty significant. Now, there's no doubt when we look at the level of super and the level of age pension that those two forms of savings actually are needed to meet the personal expenditure. There's nothing left over from them for any other costs, such as aged care or any substantive health costs. For the 25th percentile wealth group, super and age pension basically get you to the comfortable standard, and the other percentiles are also at that standard. And it's only when you drop below that, that because you're relying solely on the age pension, that you're at the comfortable standard. So, but there's no spare money in super or the age pension to meet any other costs other than personal expenditure. So then we start looking at accommodation, aged care and health costs. So aged care in particular, I think half men, two-thirds of women will need some form of aged care probably in their later life. That's the current statistics. The costs for residential care ranges from about $20,000 per annum to about $112,000 per annum, depending on the level of support you would get from the age pension. And that's an annual cost. You can also meet part of that cost through a lump sum. $20,000 or $40,000 of that per annum can also be met through a lump sum, which would be in the order of $300,000 to $550,000. So aged care is basically your accommodation costs when you don't live at home, and you will basically need your housing wealth to pay for that cost. Then there's also the additional health gap payments, because the comfortable standards, I think, allow for about $10,000 per annum in health costs. Actually, probably a bit less than that. So basically that sets out the background, and then we set, well, what are our objectives for reform? So we really said that our one objective for reform was really a better standard of living in retirement. And to do that, we need to remove any biases or impediments for accessing housing wealth if and when required. We definitely formed the view that we were not creating policy that would either encourage or discourage people to remain in their homes. It would be neutral. At the moment, the policy is probably not neutral. It probably encourages people to remain in the home because the house is the only exempt asset for the age pension. There's a strong incentive there to stay there. We're also not about targeting reductions in government expenditures, although it could be an outcome of some of the recommendations. So we're really about a better standard of living. We're really about better choices. And that's it. The principles we set for reform, we took from the Retirement Incomes Policy Paper because we thought they were appropriate for us as well. And the only thing we did was actually just expand them a little to pick up housing costs and aged care. So sustainability, we are about ensuring reliable, secure, adequate resources in retirement. Flexibility, so that people make choices and that they have transaction fluidity, so they're not stopped from making choices that would suit them because of a certain either inability to transact or the cost of transacting. Equity. There's two types of equity we're particularly focused on, where the intergenerational equity between tax concessions and age pension, and the way in which this can be thought about is it fair that someone might have a house worth $2 or $3 million and is receiving an age pension when 80% of workers are earning less than $80,000 per annum and paying tax to pay that age pension? You know, there's this cross-generational fairness thing between people who are working and people who are receiving income support. And the other is horizontal equity, taking into account all wealth. At the moment, housing wealth is very favourably treated compared to any other wealth. And the Centre of Independent Studies did some very good work earlier this year where they showed that the wealth of a single homeowner who in receipt of the full age pension was 9 times the wealth of a non-homeowner in receipt of the full age pension. Same for couples. So there's a massive disparity of wealth for two groups of people who are both receiving a single age pension. And that's because the house is so favourably treated at the moment under the age pension. So that's horizontal equity. We need to look at all wealth and try to treat people equivalently for all wealth, regardless of whether they choose to have it in a home or shares or cash in term deposits. Efficiency, and this is about the efficient use of public expenditure, which is both tax concessions and age pension and income support to ensure retirement needs are met. Simplicity, we want to minimise the need and the cost for advice and support of regulatory frameworks to support competition and consumer protection. So basically, the principles are the same as the retirement incomes policy paper, simply just tailored. And now we're getting into our reform options. So we've got three recommendations that we've come down on and three options for reform. So the first three are where we're recommending options for reform. The first one is around the age pension. Currently the home is not included at all in the age pension means test, which means that decisions about home equity are sorted by, you know, if they try to access equity in the house through downsizing or any sort of financial product, they do, if they take a lump sum, they can reduce their age pension entitlements. And the means testing is quite poorly targeted because of disparities in housing. We're picking up the point I made before about two groups of people on full age pension with vastly different wealth. So the recommendations that we've formed a view on at this stage, and this is what I said, this is not final recommendations, we are seeking your input here, is that we believe that it would be right to introduce a cap on the exemption of the home in the age pension means test, which means that beyond a certain level, and we're not dictating that level at this stage, we're just saying that there's a principle here that beyond a certain level, that asset is classified as an asset for the means testing. It would be a deemed asset. It may not be deemed in the same way as other financial assets, but it would be a deemed asset. We believe that's right to increase the fairness with people with disparate wealth in older age. We're not introducing that as a revenue measure, although it would have a positive fiscal impact, because we feel that probably the right level for setting that cap may only affect a fairly small group of age pensioners, so it's not going to drive a whole lot of revenue. That's not the point of it. The point is that it is a fairness measure. That is it really right that you can have 9 times the wealth and get the same age pension? So I'll talk a little bit more about that one at the end of this slide, because this is probably an area that is possibly going to be quite contentious in the way in which people feel that we're presenting this option for recommendation. So I'll just go through the others. Connected to that, we believe that there needs to be some protection of home equity release, whether it's through downsizing or through a financial product in the age pensions means test. Because at the moment you try to access equity, you impact yourself on the age pension. You reduce your age pension entitlements, and 70% of people are on the age pension. So it is affecting the decisions. It is forcing people to stay in larger houses. So it's not as if the government gets some money anyway. We just think that if there was a way of providing a partial protection to some equity release through either ring fencing it or through a simple depreciation schedule, then that would facilitate people to make better decisions if they want to. We recognise there's a number of risks here. So the risks are that if we start to remove some of the favourable tax concessions for homes, people may actually stop saving through their own home, which would actually be a bad thing, because people are saving through their housing, and that is a good thing. It does give them a source of wealth. Homes can fluctuate in prices quite considerably, even though some people think they never do, and that could impact the age pension flows if we're actually exempting part of the housing value from the means testing. It could give rise to any avoidance activity. There's no doubt that there's some very clever people out there that the moment you change anything, they go into a full-scale mode to work out how to avoid it. There could be ways of shifting wealth so that you can release equity and get it protected where you never actually own the house, or you only own a small house and then you buy a bigger house and things like that. So we've got to accept that there might be some clever anti-avoidance activity that might come into play here. Now, the other risk is one that came through from the UK. When the UK introduced an exemption for the house in their aged care means testing, what they found is it did force a number of people to sell, and that caused a lot of anxiety in an older, frail group. And at the end of the day, the UK government had to step in and provide some support there for those people. So it is possible that doing these sorts of things may start to force sales, and if there isn't a functioning private market to sort of help release the equity in particular, so that people don't have to sell the house but can just get hold of some equity, and if the government doesn't have a scheme that steps in as well, that you could end up forcing the selling of houses earlier than what people want to occur. So there has to be these recommendations also flow through into some other options later about what we do about the private and the public market to support people who want to access equity rather than selling their house if they no longer get the full exemption under the age pension means test. Now, if I just come back and talk about the cap on the exemption, we spent a number of time, considerable time debating whether we wanted to stipulate an amount, like 1 or 2 millions, something like that. And we felt that if we stipulated an amount, the media debate would very quickly just get hold of that amount and start showing cases of elderly ladies living in Sydney who are asset rich, income poor, and the whole debate basically gets derailed. There is an issue about what that amount should be. If it's a dollar amount, a lot of people raise the fact that there's geographic problems with that. 1 million is a very different kettle of fish in Sydney versus in a regional area of Australia. There is a view, and Colin Grenfell holds his view quite strongly, and he was going to be on webinar today, and he may wish to make some comments later through webinar. He has an alternate view that there should be a mechanism that doesn't set a dollar amount. It should be based on quartile values of housing wealth in each geographic area, and the age pension is varied accordingly to what quartile of health you're in, which is determined by land values, local council values. So there's a number of different mechanisms here, whether you set a dollar, whether you set a quartile amount, how you deal with it. But we actually didn't want to get into that. We consciously decided we did not want to get into the mechanics or the dollar quantums at this stage. We wanted to focus on, it's a very important principle that we're trying to get through. And this is going to be a very contentious area because housing, as you know, most politicians will say, don't touch it. You know, you'll get voted out next election sort of thing. So we want to focus on the fairness aspect. Is it fair that people with vastly different quantums of wealth get hold of the same age pension? And not worry about whether we're affecting, you know, 5% or 10% of age retirees, but we're probably going to indicate we would expect it to be quite a small number of age retirees that would be affected, but trying to stop this debate going off the rails, which it could very easily do. Now we move on to the private equity release schemes, some of the actions that we felt needed to occur there. The current legislation, there's two types of legislation that currently sit over private equity release schemes. So the National Consumer Credit Protection Act and APRA, for entities that are regulated by APRA. So for the Credit Protection Act, it was modified in 2012-2013 to considerably improve the protection in terms of no negative equity guarantees now have to be provided, security of tenure, LVRs, those sorts of things. So there is quite a lot of regulation in that regard sitting over reverse mortgages. The problem is that it doesn't sit over any other equity release product. So there is a lot of regulation, but it only sits over some product. 2005, the money for living failure occurred where a number of people signed over their property to a group in return for a guaranteed residency and guaranteed income stream for life. That group just simply didn't honour the guarantee and sold the properties. So we have to make sure that what regulation we have here sits over any form of product or provider that is entering this market, because we are looking at a particularly exposed group of people being elderly and frail, last source of wealth, no ability to regenerate it, and we've got to make sure that whatever financial product is occurring in this area can be trusted and safe and secure. So there is a view that the current regulation is complex. It doesn't apply to all equity release products, but there's also a view from the banks largely that it's unclear exactly issues such as responsible lending and unfair contract terms, and they're very reluctant often to get into this product because of that. In terms of the APRA regulation, if an ADI is providing support, there is additional risk and capital requirements, but that only applies to ADIs, and there's no requirement for anyone can provide this type of product. So we felt, so that's the area around consumer protection regulation. The other issue is that the complexity of the product in itself necessitates advisors and distributors to be highly trained. It is a complex product. And home equity release schemes are additionally complicated by the fact that property law is state-based. So I think there's one home reversion product. It only operates in Sydney and Melbourne because it's simply not worth their while to go through all the different property law in all the different states to have a similar product scheme across the other states. So our recommendations there are that the government develop a principles-based regulation which ensures security of tenure, which is very important, which applies across all products and providers, and which also could facilitate standardised and simple disclosures, possibly mandated, but that the disclosures would be standard and simple. Not totally, some people don't always like using an analogy of the MySuper option, but it is a similar analogy in the firm of having a simple product where you can get standardised disclosures. Third-party advisors and distributors, we felt there should be some consideration about the independent financial advice required by a borrower and also the licensing requirements for the distributors and advisors. Much like SMSF, there's specific licensing requirements there for advising on SMSFs. There's some risk that you obviously have to be careful with regulation, that you can constrain supply, that standardisation might stifle innovation, and that if you're trying to do anything to harmonise state property law, you could probably say don't bother, it's not going to happen in our lifetimes, but it's likely to be very slow. Moving on, this is the third recommendation, and this is the area that we felt really particularly strongly about, that this was a big area to consider, which is the risk of financial abuse of older Australians. At the moment, 5% of over 65s already experience financial abuse. Now, you may or may not consider that to be a material amount, but it is still a fairly significant level of financial abuse. At the moment, housing wealth is basically an illiquid store of wealth. It's not easy to actually get hold of that. If we make it easier to release that equity in different ways and almost encourage the release of it through doing things like capping exemption in the age pension, we believe that that risk of financial abuse will increase and that the actual financial abuse will increase. We think it could actually be quite a significant issue as people live longer, as the rates of dementia increase, Alzheimer's Australia views that it's going to triple by 2050, that this is a risk that is a significant risk for the future. I don't know if you've ever heard the definition of a big problem. The definition of a big problem is a small problem that was just never addressed. So we view this as being a problem that's going to increase. And we feel particularly strongly that it needs to be addressed before it's evident, not after. Now I'm going to move into the three areas where we're basically putting forward options for reform, but we're not putting them forward as strong recommendations, just simply options to consider. One is that downsizing is an important source of gaining equity, obviously. There's issues associated. There's frictions in terms of stamp duty, which makes people reluctant sometimes to downsize. Stamp duty in Victoria, $25,000 on a $500,000 house. Relief is given to new homeowners. No relief is given to retirees. It does add to the other cost of the sale. There is also a lack of suitable housing stock in many areas. If people want to stay near the area in which they're used to, there can be a lack of suitable smaller housing stock, which could be more modern. Sometimes they try to downsize and they find they don't actually get to release any equity anyway. And there's an issue about bank lending practices. Now, there's no regulation that requires banks to only lend to people with an income, but it's definitely their practice. And what we've heard from a number of people in this situation is that when they've been to banks with more than enough assets to cover any bridging finance that they would require, they are unable to access bridging finance sufficient to allow them to buy and then sell. So they're forced to sell, rent and buy, which is a considerable friction in terms of downsizing. So the options for reform there is we felt that stamp duty relief, it's considered an extremely inefficient tax anyway, and the Henry Review looked at this, that there should be some form of relief as part of the wider tax reform package, and that bank lending practices should be reviewed to ensure that there isn't this sort of transaction friction which we're hearing a lot about. Another area of options is the whole issue between homeowners and renters. The fact that homeowners within the age pension are given a considerable free asset compared to non-homeowners. The asset test values every home currently at $149,000, due to grow up to $200,000 in January. So that's the value it basically places on every home. So the difference between a non-homer is you can have an extra $200,000 of assets. That gives a substantial free asset to homeowners, which is why we get that inequity in wealth between homeowners and non-homeowners who are on both on the full age pension. The maximum rent assistance for non-homeowners, $60 per week. That basically, in all studies, shows it's probably about a quarter of what they actually need on average. So renters are often the less wealthy cohort, and they're definitely the most disadvantaged cohort under the age pension provisions. So options for reform are increase the age pension for non-homeowners and or rent assistance and relook at the assets test level to ensure that all assets are treated more equivalently rather than housing assets being given an absolute free kick compared to other assets. And finally, we're interested very much in what should be the current role, what should be the role of government going forward. The current role of government is that there's no widely available government-backed equity release scheme. There is a pension loan scheme, which has an extremely low take-up rate, which is available to part pensioners to upgrade to a full pension and then get it taken off their housing asset at the end on death. There's very few of them, 700 odd loans, so there's not much of a take-up. There's also some more localised schemes where there's rate postponement schemes that people can postpone paying part or all of their rates in return for paying it off as a lump sum when and if they sell their house. So that's the extent of the current role of government. And we looked at what the role of government should be going forward. So one is obviously financial literacy, which is almost a recommendation that comes out of every review. We did acknowledge, though, that the benefits of that might be limited, particularly for the older groups that are there now, because of the fact that it may be too late for a lot of them to actually, you know, get a lot of benefits from financial training or financial literacy. But we do think ongoing there should be an increased awareness of the use of housing wealth and how they can actually access it. One option is to take on the no negative equity guarantee risk, which happens in the US. And the idea behind that is you improve the pricing of these products. You'd want to make sure that the pricing of the products reflected the fact that those entities were no longer taking on this risk and the government was taking on. But it's interesting, the take-up rate of home equity release products in the States is only about 1.4%. So it didn't actually appear, that might be a useful thing in terms of pricing, but it didn't appear to us that alone would be enough to create the supply-demand, to solve the supply-demand issues. There may be some assistance through the AOFM providing securitisation programs for these loans. And then we start to look at the government, a more active involvement by the government, such as expanding the current pension loan scheme, or actually looking at providing a home equity release scheme themselves, which could be like a lender of last resort type arrangement, a more limited model, or it could be a universal or Medibank model where basically they're setting the pricing, setting the terms and conditions, which basically sets a floor for the private market, and maybe at the end of the day they'll exit that market when the private market builds up and adequately sort of takes over from it. So. And we do note that there is a poor history globally of government-run schemes generally. But in terms of looking at the spectrum of the role of government, from the least involvement, least risk, financial literacy, to the most involvement, most risk, it's the provision of a scheme, which may have some limitations around it. Now, what we are suggesting is that the government should look at what should be their role and that there is a spectrum, and we're not saying at this stage where they should lie on the spectrum, although we've probably noted the fact that if you do other things such as cap the exemption of the home and the age pension and you're starting to force people to want to access home equity, if there isn't a functioning private market that meets their needs, the government may have no choice but to actually enter the market. So that basically concludes where our thinking is at. So now I'm just simply going to open up to say we're really interested in getting your views on what we've put forward as where we've come down on in terms of recommendations and options for consideration. Are we missing anything? And also, we're particularly conscious of how to present our views to encourage informed debate. We don't want to derail a debate and lose all the value. We do really want to add to the value. And sometimes getting small changes is more achievable than revolution. And sometimes you've got to work out where in that spectrum you want to be and where you're most likely to get some success. So I'll open it up now to questions. So please use a microphone, name and company, and also to any webinar questions.
Michael Berg of Bryce Warner. I promise not to go too easy on Alan. So, question of, did the group, has the group yet considered certain levels of housing debt that people might have as they sort of approach retirement, and I mean in particular the sort of extent to which higher house prices mean people who might not previously have retired with mortgages would now be retiring with significant mortgages?
We are aware that I think one in three people are retiring with debt at the moment. The actual potential market for home equity release is estimated to be around the $1 trillion, and that's unencumbered. So at this stage, yes, there's an increasing trend to retire with debt, but there still is a considerable amount of unencumbered housing wealth.
Yeah, I think the other point is in looking at the group that's got the big issue is the baby boomer type group, and they don't have the same levels of debt as is coming up behind them. So it's an issue, but for this particular group, so the ones we'd be looking to implement this for in the next 10, 15, 20 years, the level of debt's not that high, and they're the ones who also don't have the same level of superannuation savings. So the other ones who are getting higher debt also have higher superannuation savings, some of which will be used to pay off that debt.
And I might also reiterate that we're not trying to force people to have to take a financial product to access equity. And this isn't about forcing anyone to do that. This is about simply saying that where people have housing wealth, we just want to make sure that if they want to use it, that they can.
John McClanahan, just on that point, I think it's interesting to note that some advisors actually recommend to people as they're retiring not to pay off their mortgage, but to keep a small amount of the mortgage available. And it's to overcome that issue of getting bridging finance so they can extend their loan if they need to, if they want to do something with it. Because they won't be able to get a loan from a bank because they don't have income. Mm. So they keep that small amount of debt, and I'm sure there's a lot of that happening, just as some sort of buffer. So that's one aspect of the debt that people hold.
Mm. Yeah, that's definitely happening. I mean, I'm a case in point. I've got a mortgage, a line of credit mortgage that I've had for 25 years, it's had a zero, in fact it's had a negative balance for the past 10 years.
Gwen Langton, GCL Consulting. A couple of points. The first one is that I firmly believe and support what you're doing in the equity release area. I think that my personal view is that one of the best longevity protections that a significant proportion of Australians can have is if they can actually have appropriate equity release from their houses at advanced ages. And therefore, I'm very keen to see that that particular market is fostered and the Institute supports that. My concern is that if you put into the same box of recommendations doing something about houses and pensions, my personal belief is you've got Buckley's of getting any traction in that area. No government, I believe, will actually actively put that to the voting public, particularly the grey voting public. And therefore, my concern is that the debate about that will subsume the really important thing that you're talking about is let's get home equity release done correctly. Because I'm sure we're all aware of cases of people, I mean, I'm personally aware of cases where people were in $2 million houses but actually couldn't afford to buy stuff to put on their table. So that's the first thing, is I would like to see, to some extent, a hierarchy. I'm concerned that your first principle is the age pension and the house, whereas my view is that's the last one. The first thing to do is to make sure that you've actually got a proper way of releasing the wealth that's stored in homes. Let's achieve that. If you achieve that, then maybe we can start thinking about doing something about the house and the age pension. But if you can't actually get proper equity release programs going, then you, by doing what you're doing about the house, you're forcing sort of potentially forcing the 80-year-old woman, widow, living in a house that's worth $5 million just because they happened to buy it 40 years ago. They've actually got to sell the house, which they don't want to do. The second point is, and I'd just like some clarification, one of the important issues that you're actually saying is that with current equity release products, they have an impact on the age pension. Now, I understand that's the case if you actually take an equity, a sort of a reverse mortgage that takes a lump sum. Yes. However, I'm personally aware of a reverse mortgage arrangement whereby what you do is you actually get a contingent debt. So basically you say, look, what you're able to do is actually able to borrow 20% of the value of the property, but you actually draw that down on a progressive basis to meet the living costs.
Yes.
And my understanding was that if those costs, the drawdown on the reverse mortgage is purely to meet the cost of living, that doesn't impact on the age pension.
No, that's right. Income doesn't have the same impact as drawing down a lump sum.
Yeah, so basically that product actually exists at the present time.
It does.
Yeah, that's only in that area of using a reverse mortgage. A lot of this equity release debate is not about reverse mortgages. There's a lot of other ways of releasing equity.
Yep.
And many of those don't have that simple, they don't have that trickle-down capacity. You do have to take it, if you want to use them, you've got to get it in slabs. So for those types of products, to make them usable, there does need to be some method to allow that money to come through without essentially having a massive marginal tax rate because of its impact on
I'd ask why. I mean, basically, if a product exists that allows people to actually take income to support themselves in living, and that has no impact on the age pension, if that's in the market...
Part of what we're saying is there's not just one product. We don't just... Yeah. The idea with this is not just to support one product being reverse mortgages. The idea is actually to have methods by which people can access their home equity that actually have an equitable treatment of those products. So there are structures that you can't arrange to have essentially annuity income from your drawdowns. You do have to work in blocks. Mm. So it would seem inefficient to the system to essentially force people to use reverse mortgages. Because as we've discovered, and the Productivity Commission's discovered, a lot of people are very, very seriously averse to a mortgage. So you can say the product's nice, you can say it works that way, they don't want to use it, they prefer to use the other style product, but then it's got a disefficiency against the means test. So if we can get all the products that have equivalency, that's a better outcome. So that's really all we're trying to say.
I'd heard some time ago that for some providers, they don't actually like the income products because they're not very profitable for them. They're like a bit of a nuisance product, whereas paying at a lump sum is much more profitable. So, yes, you're right. There are those products there now, but they're not always the product that people can get access to necessarily or that is being supplied.
Or they want.
Hi, Eric Ranson. I'm from Nisworth Inca, US. Seniors home equity provider. We provide an income to people, so it should actually work in Australia. I guess when I looked at the Australian market, I thought the government product was actually pretty good, and my understanding, which may have been incorrect, was that it was open to all people who owned a home to get up to the full pension, whether they're eligible for a partial pension or not. In which case, it seemed to me that was probably the best and cheapest option for people to use.
This is the pension and loan scheme?
Yeah.
I thought it was only available for people who were entitled to a part pension.
So, probably useful to clarify that. But yes, my very first impression was... between the kind of cultural and Australian views about home and bequests and all the rest of it, and a government scheme that appeared to do relatively efficiently what I guess the whole home equity business is trying to do. I thought that we were sort of pretty much covered there and didn't really want to get in there and compete. But just on the issue of equity and means tests, I think yes, where you were talking about whether you should mention a figure like 1 million or 2 million, I would have thought the starting point was to just say, okay, well, let's discuss fairness and throwing the whole home in. Did you consider that option?
We did, and we quickly decided not to do that because we thought we run the risk of derailing the debate anyway by putting it in, and we thought we'd actually consciously then take it down and say that we want to get in for a fairness point of view, but we'd only get it in to affect a relatively small number of pensioners simply so the debate did not get derailed totally. But there is a danger that this whole debate can get derailed by that one thing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Mm. As the gentleman behind you has pointed out.
Yeah.
Hi, Richard Cornwall, Suncorp. A couple of things. I think Catherine alluded to this just a little while ago. A lot of the sums involved in here are actually quite small, which actually is one of the issues from a provider's point of view in terms of is this really worth the effort and things in terms of compared to even banks. Currently, bank-owned life insurers and wealth managers have a problem already that when a bank is looking at a mortgage of $500,000, it's immediately got a very large revenue stream, which is sort of or even a few hundred thousand, which is a more average mortgage now compared to a few maybe a few tens or maybe $100,000 or so in an equity release scheme, which puts quite a layer of expenses on top, which also then impacts on the relative attractiveness of these things. So to the extent that potentially government could take over some of the insurance risks and require this underwriting and things like that, that would be quite useful in terms of facilitating these things. And just on the other one, in terms of including houses in tests and things, whatever the limit is, there's quite a big issue about valuations because it's quite a practical issue that if you look at real estate agents, they don't seem to really get prices accurate to within 20%, but that can be a quite a material impact on people's pensions if they're going to move the valuation by a few hundred thousand and things? And also, who's going to pay for these valuations? Is the government going to pay $1,000 a valuation? Because it's not a trivial exercise to value retail things. And if you run it off unimproved land values, those only get updated pretty irregularly, and people don't really bother arguing with them too much because a variation in those probably ends up making a few hundred dollars difference in your rates, whereas if it's going to make thousands of dollars of difference in your pensions and things. And also, to the extent that asset tests sort of tend to be very hard to change, they currently have extremely high marginal tax rate, implied tax rates, okay, because interest rates are so low. So if you lose like an extra $100,000 of assets, only converts to $2,000 or $3,000 of income at the moment, if you can put it in a deeming account or something. So it's not so there are very high implied, so there are a lot of practical difficulties in those things there, which I don't seem to ever see get considered in this, because I certainly, but I don't think everyone might go out and set up a house valuation business if the things are going.
So on a couple of those points, yes, there's only like 40,000 reverse mortgages in Australia, five providers or whatever, or four providers for reverse mortgages. And yes, that was a common view we heard, that it's actually just such a small business. Why would a bank even focus on it, particularly when it comes with quite high other risks as well, and you can't get diversity of property and all that. And it's interesting, when we looked at global, you know, there was really quite a low global take-up anywhere across, you know, US, Canada, UK. So that is an issue for why would a big bank invest a whole lot of money in this area when it's never, you know, their priority of spending their capital is just going to be somewhere else. The valuation issue, we haven't got into the mechanics of that. I think it would have to be done through some form of local council rates type approach. And I know in the past we've often shied away from doing these things, saying, well, the difficulty means that you don't do it, it's not worth the revenue, this isn't a revenue measure by any means. But at the end of the day, there is fairness and there is a cross-generational equity issue here. So if we can solve them, I agree that mechanics won't be easy, but if we can solve that, would it be better?
Michael Berg again. Perhaps just a couple of observations on obstacles to supply, and I mean this is informed by a particular legacy product which I'm helping to at least sort of limit the damage on. I think that it's something where it's quite difficult to get the structure of a product exactly right, and that if the provider buys a percentage of the home and the value goes up a lot, then it can look like they've got an extortionate return on the capital. If it goes down, they've got the risk on that, or if it doesn't go up by what they're looking for. That causes issues in terms of availability of finance for the provider. If they have a variable interest rate and the rate goes up, then people will be upset. If they have a fixed interest rate and the rate goes down, then people will be upset, especially if the provider has hedged the interest rate at the higher fixed level with very long-term interest rate swaps. Ouch. Then you've also got the risk of default on the reverse mortgages if you get a situation where the mortgage lands up outstripping the value of the property, and again that goes to pricing and it goes to availability. And I mean, I'm not sure exactly where that gets us to in terms of policies, but I'm thinking that's probably something worth exploring further to just try and identify what policy measures would be needed to make it more workable to actually provide those products. And I think there's a bit of experience on that in Australia. I think there's also the UK has got no shortage of stories of, I think it's sort of tried every variation of equity release, and every variation has had issues, but again that sort of informs us on what the problems are, and perhaps on what can create a more functioning market. Just looking at the commentary of what product you really need to make it work in the Australian system is actually you do need something where you draw the money down pretty much month by month to avoid the issues with the means testing. But then you sort of have the question of what does that mean in terms of supply of capital, that for that your people using securitized markets can't really play there because they only need to be delivering lump sums all at once. And the people who've got the scale and liquidity to provide that month-by-month finance, being the very biggest banks, are deterred from being in the market because of the reputational risks that I mentioned earlier. And then the sort of little elephant hiding in the corner of the room is sort of in terms of the advisor remuneration, that I suspect a lot of that will be a percentage of the amount that gets lent. So that's potentially a bias towards lump sums and lack of incentive for the sort of monthly payments, which are what people actually need.
Yeah, the point about the risk, that was one we looked at quite a lot early on, and that was the thought of that was a place where the government might have a role to help with a no negative equity guarantee, as in the US. But as Cathy said, their experience is not particularly different from ours, despite the fact that there's a government guarantee. So it's not entirely clear that that would solve this supply-demand problem. The issue about the trickle-down drawdowns, you've raised a number of others, which is the remuneration for the advisors who are currently paid on commissions, but whether they'd be prepared to switch across to a fee and then the person who's drawing the income be prepared to pay that fee in a very complex area like this where the advice would be relatively expensive, that's another question. So, again, that was also the sort of the considerations we had in looking at that's trying to fit the product to the current means testing. So that's why we're suggesting that there needs to be some method to allow people to not necessarily draw it in little pieces, but without having this major negative or high, very high marginal tax rate on that lump sum that comes out.
Just a couple of extra points. One is you focus on fairness as a determinant. I think you have a can of worms there when if someone has a 50 square home in sort of Adelaide and they have a 3-bedroom home in Sydney, the same price. Well, in fact, probably let's say that the home in Sydney is actually more expensive. To argue that the value of the home that each of them have is a determinant of their wealth and whether they should actually get the pension or not, I think presents some difficulties for me, because basically the person who's living in the 50 square home in Adelaide that falls below whatever threshold we have gets the pension, compared to live in Adelaide with lower living standards, etc., compared to the person that has a much smaller house in Sydney, much higher living costs, but doesn't get the pension because they've got more wealth. The second point I'd make is that with the reverse mortgage area, that because the big organisations don't actually do it for a lot of the reasons that have been talked about, what you have is you have third parties that become aggregators. And I'm again aware of the problem with aggregators where they're actually getting finance from someone else. One of the big banks is that when the GFC occurred, suddenly that source of finance dried up, and they effectively, well, because it was rolling finance, they effectively went broke because they didn't have the continuing level of finance. And the third point I make is that I believe that one of the major reasons why equity release programs, in particular reverse mortgages, are not actually used a great deal is because of the advice that people are getting. It's basically, and you put up, one of the points you put up early on was that it's not actually, house wealth is not actually taken into account in financial planning strategic, and that's my experience, that the house is set, what we'll do is we'll develop all this financial planning and superannuation and sort of buy equities over here, and the house is over there and it's separate and it's not actually part of the overall financial planning, particularly for retirement. I think that if we could actually improve the understanding and the quality of advice in this area, you'd suddenly find that there'd be a much greater use, particularly if the big financial planning organisations had some form of equity release program as one of their recommended products. I mean, again, one of the problems you've got with financial planning organisations, you can only offer what's on the list. And so if you haven't got reverse mortgages or some form of equity release on the list, you can't offer it.
Thanks, Glenn.
Yeah, I think one of the things we did come to here is there's a chicken and egg problem here. There's a supply side problem and there's a demand side problem, and the demand side problem exacerbates the supply side problem, and then the supply side problem exacerbates the demand side problem. So we ourselves went round and round and round and round a number of times. That's why we try to find ways that we can essentially remove some of these frictions, and looking at better advice, looking at the things that actually make that advice bias against people using it, et cetera, et cetera. So it was to try and get rid of those inefficiencies and the frictions to see, and really set it up therefore that you had a playing field upon which sensible, rational financial decisions can be made.
That's right. It's not unlike the case for deferred annuities. There's legislation at the moment that just rules out deferred annuities. No, I don't think that there's 70% of people on the age pension. You know, I think the role for deferred annuities is limited now, but possibly growing. But it doesn't mean we don't want to get legislation changed so that the product could be there for people to want it. And it's a bit like here. We've got regulation at the moment on some product, but not all. Well, why don't we just clean up the system and make sure that if there becomes a bigger demand, if people are willing to supply, at least it's well regulated. We're not necessarily saying there's going to be a massive market here. We're just saying, what do we need to do, as Alan said, to remove the stuff that's getting in the way of people using things that they might want to use. I was just going to throw it open and say, get some sort of feedback from you. And the people on webinar, if you sort of want to send through your views on this, your yes or no's as well, we'll collect it later. But if we just look through our reform options, our recommendations, the first one is around the age pension. Now, taking your point, Glenn, whether we put it first or last or whatever. And there's probably two questions around here. Do you think we should still put it up as an option? And the second one is, you know, do you think we should sort of play it down, like still put it up, but, you know, keep it in the small print sort of thing, or at the sixth option level? So the first one is the issues around the age pension about picking up, it's an issue of fairness, it's about picking up some value of housing wealth, because housing wealth is wealth, it is wealth, in the exemption, and also allowing for some equity release which doesn't affect the age pension. What's, like, in a small show of hands, do people think that that is an option we should continue to persist with? And the second question will be, but do we need to play it down even more than what we have? So what do people think? Is it an option we should persist with? Right. It's probably no point asking the second question then. About playing it down.
I have to work just to make sure
I have to do the Right, okay. What if we had it, but we kept it at the back and sort of said, look, in the longer term, you need to do this? How would people feel about that?
So it's in the options.
It's in the options, so but not necessarily
just not a recommendation.
Yeah, probably works better.
Okay, more hands?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
As a separate piece.
So it doesn't... So disconnected from the stuff. So disconnected, so it
doesn't... Disconnected from the piece where it doesn't impact, so there's some sort of scalable way that it doesn't impact the other piece. Is that what essentially you're saying?
A separate piece of separate discussion.
So it doesn't derail the other...
Okay. Kathy,
we
should include that at
the same time as we limit the amount of money people have in superannuation funds
to get tax exemption. Sorry, but the other question, there's actually two parts to that piece about the means test. The one part is we cause some part of the house to be taken into account. The second part of it is where people release some of their equity, that there's some form of either exemption or things. So are you suggesting we move both of these things, or just the first one? Just the first one. Yes, okay.
Okay, so I should have separated them. Good point. Is the exemption, are people happy with the exemption of equity that's released?
Yeah.
Part of all? Okay.
That's an efficiency factor. Yeah.
So if you take a lump sum out of your house of $200,000, and then that should not be taken into account in the same way as $200,000 I've got in shares.
Yes, so it's
That's the idea. It's
all or part of it. It's not necessarily saying all of it, and it's not necessarily saying from a financial product. It could be from downsizing as well. But it's saying it is exempt now, sitting in the house, and all or part of it would remain exempt for a period of time.
I see no reason that any lump sum taken out should be exempt.
Okay, so you're not a hand up.
Because the product
can
be used to pay for income, and that's all that we're really concerned about. That, you know, however the equity release is, as long as it provides for, where it provides for income support or expense support, then it shouldn't have an impact on the age pension. But I can't see why a lump sum that comes out of your house should be treated any differently to an equity, a sort of a share program that you've actually developed.
All right.
Sorry, I guess this is all about transitions as well.
Yeah.
Which we probably need to talk a little bit about.
Yeah.
Sorry. I was just saying, I think this is a lot also about just transitions. Obviously, people are in a situation now. They have housing wealth, and the rules are such that they've orchestrated their assets in a certain way, but obviously, you know, what we would want to maybe set up in 20 years' time could be very different. Then we might all agree that, well, all assets are equal. So it's a case of, I guess, also how we transition from here to there.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, Michael Berg again. I think this is a good example of how something that would make sense but comes in the wrong place can result in the debate being derailed, because there's a lot of emotion around the sort of cap on the what value of home would be exempt from age pension means testing. Personally, I think there should be a cap of that nature, but it's not going to happen soon. And if that's sort of linked to better equity release mechanisms, then the better equity release mechanisms are just not going to happen for quite a long time. When you say if you have a cap on the what value of home is exempt from the age pension, then you have to accompany that with better equity release mechanisms. But you can have better equity release mechanisms without the something that forces people to use them.
That's a good point.
I might just read out two questions from Chris Condon. So the first one is about any work done on health and other benefits keeping people in the homes as far as possible. Are the health and other costs being borne by society when older people are forced for financial reasons to leave the homes they have lived in for decades? So take that one first. There is a view that remaining in home can be better for people for as long as they can and want to. And the Living Longer, Better, Living Better reform packages sort of acknowledge that to some extent. And improve the sort of care that people could get in homes. So what we're specifically trying to do is actually not force people one way or the other. At the moment, you could argue that the age pension forces people to remain in home long after when that home is appropriate for them. So we're just trying to remove anything that force people one or the other. We're not trying to actively force people to move out of the homes that they've lived in, if in fact that is the most appropriate place for them to remain in and get in-home care in.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the other things is that whole system has looked at increasing the amount of care at home so that it's not being done in expensive government-financed facilities, and therefore reduces that impost on the public purse. So to some extent, yes, that's by staying in the home, but that's actually the system is set up to do that as long as possible. And they're only really moving into, I think Kathy's figure was, what, about 3 years. The real aged care stuff is on average only about 3 years.
Two years.
That's even shorter than I thought it was. Is only really 2 years. So it's really those people who cannot be looked after at home who have to go into a facility. And that, to some extent, does make the system reasonably efficient, because then the expensive capital facilities are used for the ones who absolutely have to use them rather than anybody.
The second question is a potential product designed to ensure guaranteed lifetime tenancy, being selling the home with settlement delayed until death? The deposit would be substantial, for example, 60%, which would be the equity release. So the point that we're trying to make in terms of the regulation is to say at the moment there's a lot of regulation but only sitting on one product, and there's some additional regulation that sits on ADIs that are regulated by APRA. And we're trying to make sure that whatever regulation there is, it would be principles-based, so it would sit across any product or any design. It wouldn't just be reverse mortgages. It would be equity release or home reversion or any other product that would be designed to meet people's needs, and it would ensure security of tenure and some other basic things. So we're not trying to dictate product here. We're just trying to make sure that whatever regulation there is appropriate, but which sits over everything rather than just one part of the market, which is what it does now.
Okay,
so that was interesting on the age pension. So if we then go to the regulation, and the options we put forward here is this principles-based regulation that sits over everything, so I might deal with that one first. So hands up. Do people think that's a good idea rather than having regulation that sits over one product and nothing over others? Generally, mostly, yeah. What about the issue about third-party advisors, distributors? So one is about, should there be a requirement to take advice by the borrower before entering into these products? Do you think that should be in some way forced? No hands?
I think a little bit? Yeah. One of the principles you had was simplicity.
Well, the facts are that if you're talking to an 80-year-old an 80-year-old widow who's never, and that's what you're going to be talking to in most a significant proportion of cases, that who's never basically not being looked after finances or that sort of thing historically, doesn't know how simple it is that they will actually need to have someone provide advice. The second reason that you need to have advice is that the problem with retirees is often their risk appetite, that you, if you ask them what their risk appetite is, in fact, they come up to be much more conservative than they actually should, that it's in their best interests. And so this not only affects sort of reverse mortgages, it affects debt in retirement. You know, clearly, in a lot of cases, debt in retirement is going to be a good thing. It's going to make their life better. But they, if you ask them whether they want debt in retirement, they say no. So they actually need to have someone who provides advice to them to say this is a good thing.
Okay.
That's so you're essentially supporting the view that before anyone can enter into any product of this sort, they must have advice.
And I've got personal experience where that was actually, it was a requirement. They actually had to go to a financial advisor.
Okay, just might try and get through some of these a little bit quickly. What about requiring distributors and advisors to have specific licensing arrangements, much like we have in place now for SMSFs? Do people think, because it's complicated, because this group of people is particularly exposed to being missold? So the general yes? Okay. All right. Just quickly going over. The risk of elder financial abuse of older people, we're particularly called that out. We haven't said what the answer is, but we're particularly called it out as saying there's got to be something in place, and maybe the thing in place is partly the answer to the other two questions. But do people agree that this is an increasing risk and we need to do something before it becomes a known problem?
Yes.
So yes? Okay.
In California, they have elder abuse laws and things like that, which is just general.
That's interesting.
Which I think is a good idea.
California, almost a bit like Part 4A tax evasion.
I think.
A sort of all encompassing.
I'm generally not happy about all this regulation, but I think that Part 4A and
general things can be good. Mm-hmm. Now, these were some of the options. What the issue about stamp duty relief? And it would have to be part of a wider package of tax reform, because we can't just keep handing back money. You know, we're in 40 years of government deficits anyway. So, but as part of a wider package of reform, do people think it's right that first-time owners get a relief, but people wanting to restructure later end of life don't get relief? Oh, so is it a hands up, yes, there should be some consideration of stamp duty relief, or no?
Some consideration. I mean, one of the other suggestions is that it get paid, but over some longer period, not big sums at the front, which cause problems.
Okay. And the final thing that I'm going to raise is the government role. So should there be a government scheme, like an income scheme, like expanding the pension loan scheme? I'm pretty sure it's only the other people who are actually eligible for the part pension now, not everyone. Should there be a government scheme that picks up income only and that is there? So hands up, yes. Okay, that's interesting. Yep, all right. Should the government carry the no negative equity guarantee?
They're losing billions in the US for changing the reverse mortgage scheme now.
Right, okay. Yep, so it's probably a no. Yep, right.
So government's losing millions.
Mm.
Billions.
On that.
Yeah, so they've changed the reverse mortgage scheme, it's been postponed, the delays.
Right, okay.
But I understand they've got a million reverse mortgages out there, so.
Now, a question from the webinar from Tim Habel. In terms of changing the inclusion of the home and the means test, have the presenters considered using and adding an implementation of, say, the change applying to people born after the year 1980 only? Yeah, wonderful.
Yes, I think anything that hurts people that's applied to people born after 1980 is a much better idea.
No, but I think that comes to the transition issue that Elaine mentioned before, that all these things that maybe the only way you can ultimately ever get anything that affects a family home is to sort of say that there's a long lead time before people do start to get affected. So I think that's a worthwhile point to consider in terms of trying to make that option appear more palatable. What do people think? Is it worthwhile including this? Mm. Do you think it's just...
Yeah, it's transition.
All right, I think that pretty well brings us to the end. So does anyone want to make any final comments on where we're going with this? All right, well, thank you, and thanks to everyone on the webinar. And Alan, and I think... we can stay on chat for a little while. Thanks, everyone.